I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. President Obama won re-election after a hard-fought race. He handily defeated Governor Romney in the electoral vote count and in the popular vote by about 2 percentage points. Speaking early this morning in Chicago, the president said that cooperation can solve the country's pressing problems.
Tonight, you voted for action, not politics as usual. You elected us to focus on your jobs, not ours. And in the coming weeks and months, I am looking forward to reaching out and working with leaders of both parties to meet the challenges we can only solve together. Reducing our deficit, reforming our tax code, fixing our immigration system, freeing ourselves from foreign oil. We've got more work to do. But that doesn't mean your work is done. The role of citizen in our democracy does not end with your vote. America's never been about what can be done for us. It's about what can be done by us together through the hard and frustrating but necessary work of self-government. That's the principle we were founded on.
Governor Romney called for unity in his concession speech to his supporters in Boston.
The nation, as you know, is at a critical point. At a time like this, we can't risk partisan bickering and political posturing. Our leaders have to reach across the aisle to do the people's work.
Today on Radio Times, making sense of the results of the 2012 election, and you can give us a call. We want to hear from you. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. We asked Julian Zelizer to join us. He's a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University, the author of a number of books, including most recently Governing America, The Revival of Political History. Julian Zelizer, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. David Mark, also back with us on Radio Times, editor-in-chief of Politics, previously a senior editor at Politico, and is the author of a book that came out just a couple of years ago called Going Dirty, The Art of Negative Campaigning. And David Mark, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
My pleasure. Good to be here.
And David, if I could begin with you, only because something that you wrote early this morning, that Obama's victory was not so surprising. How so?
Right. If we looked at the contours of the Electoral College map, the states President Obama actually won. This was predictable, or at least something close to it, back in April or May, just going off the 2008 results. We knew the basic map, the swing states that were going to be in play. They're all familiar now, Colorado, Virginia, Ohio. And if you just looked at the consistent polling leads, President Obama seemed in decent shape in most of these places. In addition, with just knowing the caliber of the campaign strategists that the president's team had on board, they were clearly slicing and dicing the electorate demographics, and they clearly were going to have a superior, quote-unquote, ground game, get-out-the-vote operation, and that all pretty much came to form, and it looked just like it might have a few months ago.
Well, Julian, is it all about the ground game?
Well, that was important. We do have to start with just looking at the map, and you could watch it last night as Romney started to struggle. He was coming from behind from the start. So Romney really had an uphill struggle to win this, and he never, did what he had to do. Part of it was the ground game. Part of it were the strategies of the Romney campaign, such as not responding to the onslaught of Obama's ads very early on to define him as a, vulture capitalist, a creature of Maine. And then there were mistakes over foreign policy that were made and other issues. So it was ground game, it was campaign strategy, and finally it was just the electoral map, which in this case really favored Obama.
But David, looking at who in broad terms supported the president, we're talking about a majority of women, we're talking about a majority of minorities. I think he got something like 71% of the Latino vote and younger voters as well. What does that tell us about the country that we live in?
It's clearly a sign of a rapidly diversifying population, especially in the states that actually decide presidential elections. Last time around, Virginia and Colorado went Democratic. They voted for President Obama, the first time backing a Democrat in many years. This is the second straight election that states like Virginia and Colorado have gone for the Democratic ticket, and so you can't really call it a fluke anymore. There's clearly some underlying statistic demographics that are changing in these places that basically make it much tougher for Republicans to win elections, just frankly, with white voters. They did in 2010 in congressional races with much smaller voting pools, but on a national scale, the country is simply becoming too diverse too fast for Republicans to keep up the trend and expect to be competitive in national presidential elections.
Julian, do you think the GOP needs to do some soul searching about its identity?
Oh, absolutely. And I don't think this election in particular taught us this. I think the Republicans have known this for a while. There's people who've been talking about the demographics, and clearly the most dramatic from this last election is the Latino vote. You know, the Republicans have been divided for over a decade on this issue. There's been a wing of the Republican Party with George W. Bush, with business interests that want to favor liberalized immigration policy, and then there's a hardline anti-immigration faction. And the latter has been winning in many ways within the GOP, and they paid for it last night. They're not going to win in states like Colorado or Nevada if they continue on this path. So I think there's going to be a lot of pressure within the GOP to do something about this.
Well, and looking at, and I realize neither of you are women, but that's okay. I will ask you this question anyway to you, David. But I wonder, too, whether the Republican Party has a problem when you have candidates, not Romney, but when you have candidates who are talking about things like legitimate rape, whether when that becomes at least a statement that has legs, so to speak, whether that hurts the party as well.
Oh, without a doubt. These are what might be called fringe issues that very few mainstream candidates want to discuss, even if a lot of Republican voters kind of agree with the sentiment, the anti-abortion sentiment underlying what was said. It was just the way it was expressed that I think caught a lot of people really by surprise. And just the clips that got replayed repeatedly of Todd Akin in Missouri using that quote-unquote legitimate rape phrase, or Richard Murdoch suggesting rape-induced abortion or lack thereof is God's will or whatever it was he actually said. And they just look kind of callous and flip in their mannerisms, the way the inflection in their voice. And I think a lot of people women particularly said, you know, who are these people? Where are they coming from? And that is a big challenge Republicans have in that anti-abortion sentiment is not quite a majority opinion in the country. And that's something else they've got to grapple with. The other problem is it's the activist base that cares most about these sorts of issues. So that leads to a real confrontation coming on.
And are you surprised, Julian, that abortion, at least for a while, was so much a focus of the campaign?
It is very surprising. Look, you know, from the start, Republicans knew that the way to win this campaign, this election, was through the economy. And even the exit polls last night confirmed that was President Obama's greatest vulnerability. But it was as almost as if candidates in the GOP couldn't resist the temptation to go to other issues. And the abortion comments were obviously very striking, and I think that was the last thing most Republicans wanted to hear. But when they heard him, it was too late. It was out there, and it helped to confirm this impression of where the party is that makes this gender cap a permanent part of the campaigns. There were also voter registration issues, immigration comments going back to the Republican primaries. The party just couldn't stay away from the social and cultural questions, which all of Romney's advisors knew would not win this election, but that's where they are.
And this phrase, I want my country back, Julian, what do you think that phrase meant?
I think there's different interpretations of it. For many conservatives, there's a sense that in general, the country's moved in a more liberal direction. For some more fringe elements, there's a more kind of noxious interpretation of who's, you know, taken over the country, whether it's racial or whether it's a quasi-liberal northeastern elite. But look, even the map last night shows this country is on many political questions still very divided. This is not a landslide victory. So I think there's a sentiment on both sides that when the other wins, that somehow it's not the essence of what the country is, that the existing leader, the new president, doesn't represent the values of all of America. And that's a problem if we think of our politics that way.
And I do want to talk about that. But, David, since you wrote a book called Going Dirty, and many eyes on Ohio last night to see which way it was going to go, but there was this Jeep ad that the Romney campaign ran in that state, falsely claiming that Jeep was going to ship jobs to China. Do you think that hurt the Romney campaign?
It certainly eroded the Romney campaign's credibility, and it's a prime example of why candidates have to be so careful how they deploy negative campaigning. If you put out a claim that is untrue or even just questionable, it's going to come back to bite you. Media fact-checkers, obviously the opposition, are really going to tear into it with all kinds of research, and there's really strong incentive not to do that. So I was surprised they went ahead with that. It was clearly an attempt to kind of go after the strength of the opponent, almost a swift vote attempt in Ohio, where the auto bailout was quite popular, to somehow undermine the president's strength. And I think that's a classic example of negative campaign tactics falling short and being rather ineffective and even counterproductive.
Well, and when you have the, what was it, I believe the CEO of Chrysler basically repudiating the ad, David, that seems pretty unusual.
Right, and this may have been an attempt to get out the Republican base in Ohio such that it is to sort of rally conservatives. Maybe internal polling on the Romney side suggested they were going to lose. They had to try a quote-unquote Hail Mary pass, something of that nature. But it seemed like an odd move. It kind of provoked the opposition. I think it's a cautionary tale for future Republican statewide campaigns in Ohio and elsewhere.
Julian, was this a particularly dirty campaign season, do you think?
Well, you know, I think we sometimes exaggerate that this campaign was the dirtiest and nastiest of all, but obviously you can look at the Swift boat attacks in 2004. Many people felt the same way. You can go back to the 1988 campaign between George H.W. Bush and Michael Dukakis with the Willie Horton ad, and you find this all the time. So I'm not sure it's the nastiest. I think we're in an era when these are the kind of campaigns that we run, as David has written about. I do think, though, that that ad on the cars points to this other issue in the campaign about class and economics, where Republicans really struggled from the 47% remark that Mitt Romney made and the Democratic ads about him and Bain Capital. They became seen as the party of the rich, and this partly reflected policy choices with tax cuts and deregulation, and it reflected statements. And Romney struggled in places like Ohio to win working and middle-class votes, and that was an attempt to counteract the fact that he had been lukewarm on the auto bailout, which many in these areas depended on. And I think that's another issue the Republicans have to contend with.
Well, let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation talking with Julian Zelizer and David Mark about the 2012 election, the fact that President Obama won last night. It was a hard-fought race, a very expensive race as well. And we want to hear from you, 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. What do you make of the election results? Call us. We'll be right back.
WHYY is supported by the Cooper Bone and Joint Institute, managing severe orthopedic injury and joint disease. Their team of fellowship-trained and board-certified joint replacement surgeons, rheumatologists, and physical therapists are committed to using an advanced approach to joint care, individualized for each patient. Cooper Bone and Joint Institute, with locations in South Jersey and Newtown Square. More at cooperhealth.org/ortho or 800-8-COOPER.
This Week in This American Life. Everybody knows that politics is now so divided in our country. The two sides are like two different realities, two versions of the world in collision. This week on our show, we hear from people who have seen this infect their personal lives. They've lost friends. They've become estranged from family members. Our political civil war and its personal consequences. It's a special election edition of our show this week.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
Widener University supports WHYY and offers graduate degree programs including allied health, business, education, higher education, nursing, and more, giving students hands-on leadership experience designed to help advance careers in today's challenging economy. More online at widener.edu. That's widener.edu to learn more. Widener University. Widener Leadership Works. Widener University supports WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen, talking with David Mark and Julian Zelizer. And we want to hear from you how you analyze the 2012 election and last night's results. Do give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. And again, David Mark, Editor-in-Chief of Politics, that's P-O-L-I-T-I-X, and Julian Zelizer, Professor of History and Public Affairs at Princeton University. Julian, I want to quote something that the president said last night as he ended his speech. I believe that we can seize this future together because we're not as divided as our politics suggest. We're not as cynical as the pundits believe. We are greater than the sum of our individual ambitions and remain more than a collection of red states and blue states. Harkening back to the speech he made that, in a sense, put him on the map even before he became president, do you think he's right that we're not as divided as our politics suggest?
Well, I think he's right and wrong. I think if you look at the electorate and you look at polls about where people stand on many issues, it's often much more confusing than you'd think if you look at the map. There's many people who want some kind of center on issues like abortion or on issues like health care. But our political system clearly is polarized. The parties don't have as many moderates as they did just 30 years ago. The media system does tend to favor, you know, coverage of partisan attacks and partisan division. And in Congress, you know, the party leaders have a lot of tools at their disposal to keep people in line. And the way campaign finance works also puts pressure on legislators to stay toward their respective sides of the aisle. So he might be right on the public, and he might be tapping into a real difference between what we hear and what the reality is out there, but our political system remains the same, and he's going back to the same Washington that exists right now, and so I think it will be hard to accomplish that.
David, do you see it as the people versus the political system?
I think Julie makes excellent points. There's actually a lot of institutional incentives for lawmakers not to compromise because of their basis of funding, of support, also potential primary challenges. We were just mentioning some of the Republican Senate losing candidates, Todd Akin and Richard Murdoch. At least in the case of Murdoch, he upset Richard Lugar, a Senate institution in Indiana there for almost 36 years, a bipartisan chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee. And in states with smaller populations where you can win a primary with, frankly, a smaller amount of people, there's kind of incentive to be more extreme, and I don't know how that bodes for any compromise with President Obama, probably not particularly well, and also the media culture. As Julian said, you have all kinds of bloggers and analysts analyzing every little thing that's said in a debate on Twitter, everything's dissected. There's just not a lot of room for broader reflection and kind of strategizing for the nation's good.
Just picking up on that, and we'll get to our callers, Julian, but does that, I mean, if both of you are correct and partisanship remains, does that mean we don't deal with a fiscal cliff, we don't deal with immigration, we don't deal with tax reform? I mean, these are all issues I think that everyone can agree need to be tackled in one form or another.
Well, it will be difficult, but it's not impossible, meaning even when you have deeply divided parties and party leaders who don't want to agree with each other, sometimes they have political incentives to do that, and they will. With immigration reform right now, Republicans might end up agreeing on some kind of bill with the president, not because they like him, not because they want to cooperate with him, because they're terrified of what's going to happen in 2016 if they don't do something to win over some Latino votes. And similar on other issues, even deficit reduction. I think both parties have incentives to do this and then see who could make the most of it. So there are ways sometimes in which partisan competition can actually fuel progress on legislation. This is how civil rights worked in the 50s and 60s when both parties were vying to be the party of civil rights.
But I wonder, too, David Mark, as Mitch McConnell famously said when President Obama won for the first time, that their goal was to defeat him and not allow him a second term. Now that he's won that second term, does that change either their message or their strategy?
Well, I think we have to differentiate the different types, various types of legislation that are going to be ahead of us. With immigration reform, that is something that a lot of the Democratic base would very much like to see, particularly Hispanic voters, but there's no real deadline on that. When we look at the so-called fiscal cliff, That's coming up. That's at the turn of the year on several fronts. The so-called sequestration, the defense cuts, also cuts to social programs if a deficit reduction deal is not reached. Also the expiration of the Bush-era tax cuts, which are going to affect most working Americans in a profound way on payroll taxes, what they see in their paycheck every 2 weeks or whatever the pay increment is. So I think there's actually some immediate issues where we will see some sort of compromise within the next 6 to 7 weeks. As Julian alludes to, lawmakers may be dragged into it kicking and screaming, but they have some incentive to have these off. With the broader national issues like immigration and some of the other issues, trade, et cetera, I think there are longer-term problems of partisanship that have to be worked out. I'm not as optimistic on those matters.
And that's David Mark joining us along with Julian Zelizer talking about the 2012 election and last night's results and what that means for the future of the country, of the parties, of the president. And we want to hear from you at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. We are trying to make sense of the 2012 election. Let's see what Jan from Westchester has to say. And Jan, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Good morning, Marty.
Good morning.
It's an honor to be on your show.
Thank
and I
you.
Appreciate it.
Sure.
When I listen to how much money was spent on this election, I'm horrified that it went to our election and could have been used in other ways. And I think when I look at the next 4 years, regardless of who you voted for, there are issues that the American people need to be concerned about that I think are getting lost in government. And that's the amount of money we spend on the elections, the election reform, as well as limiting terms for Congress. I think people that are there 30 years that make a career out of it possibly forget why they were voted in. And it becomes more about their own personal political agenda than it does about what the people need. I mean, this is a government of the people, by the people, and for the people, not one certain socioeconomic class, but for all of us.
Well, Jan,
and I think it's time for us to pull together and look at that, and especially how much we spend on these elections, which is just, for me, almost sinful.
Well, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Let me toss that to you, Julian. And I was reading this morning something like $6 billion, that's with a B, $6 billion spent on the 2012 election.
Yeah, immense amounts of money. There are various factors behind this. The Supreme Court decision with Citizens United that unleashed or removed limitations that had been important. The end of the Watergate public finance system, which both parties have now abandoned. All of this leads to this flood of money by the parties, by independent groups. Unfortunately, you rarely have government reform in the United States other than when some big scandal takes place. There's only been a few periods, the 70s, the progressive era, a little in the 90s, when something happens that triggers a kind of reform. Otherwise, politicians have no incentive to do this because they benefit from the system, and voters tend to focus on bread and butter questions. So I don't think that's going to happen now. I don't think the president is going to invest his so-called political capital in these issues unless, you know, some unseemly story emerges. But clearly we're in a period where the connections are just too close between private money and politics.
But I wonder, David, for those who supported Romney, obviously on the losing side, whether they're doing some soul-searching about whether that was money well spent. And also, it wasn't so true in Pennsylvania, but I know in Ohio, if you were watching television, it was essentially, you know, wall-to-wall ads. And one wonders whether that's actually a smart investment of money.
That's an important question about how effective a lot of this spending is. And that's one of the reasons I respectfully take issue somewhat with the premise of the caller's point that there's something nefarious about all this money. After all, this is democracy. $6 billion combined aggregate is sure a lot of money, but I saw a figure that about $7 billion was spent on Halloween a couple weeks ago and all kinds of other activities that Americans take part in. So I think for Democratic activities, it's just, right or wrong, very difficult to decouple. And most importantly is the effectiveness of it. We saw in these expensive Senate races in Ohio and elsewhere, also during the primaries, the outside benefactors, the quote-unquote super PAC funders, supported candidates like Newt Gingrich and Rick Santorum, and they lost in the primary. So I just don't think a lot of this money is nearly as effective as many people think it is. I think message still matters and trumps it in many
Not all, but many cases.
And Linda McMahon, running for the Senate in Connecticut, she did this 4 years ago, lost both times, and I think spent, this is her own money, something like $90 to $100 million, Julian.
Yeah, I think, I mean, there's a question of how much money should be spent, and there's many who think we don't even spend enough on these elections. I think that where the problem is and where the concern is, A, what kind of pressure does all this fundraising place on politicians? Because regardless of whether it's effective or not, the constant attention to this and the perceived need of this money, by most accounts, is risky to put this pressure on politicians. And second, you know, who does have access and who doesn't have access when it comes to policymaking, when it comes to legislating? This is what the interest groups are trying to buy. How the money is spent is another issue. It's very different than the legitimacy of it, but there are questions. You know, all this money was spent. It didn't pay off in many of these campaigns. Supporters of it will say it's a negative, that we don't know what would have happened if the money wasn't spent. It could have been that much worse for all the candidates.
Well, let me see what Tim from Wilmington has to say. And Tim, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yeah. Hi, Marty.
I just
wanted to say that I think that most Americans are somewhere in the middle between what the left has to say and what the right has to say. And I think that with the media, it sort of tries to divide people into groups, and you're either with the Republicans and the things that they say, or with the Democrats and the things that they say. And I think the fact is that most Americans are somewhere in the middle, and I think the reason that Barack Obama won is because he was basically a more moderate candidate, and I just think that people tend to vote for the middle, and I think that we're seeing the results of that today.
Tim, thanks for the call to Radio Times. David, do you agree with Tim, our caller?
Generally so. Just looking at the popular vote, right now it's essentially 50 to 49 in favor of Obama over Romney. We'll see what the final numbers are, but they'll be somewhere in that range. And in a lot of these key swing states, Obama won, but rather narrowly. So I do think the country is generally centrist and moderate, and the Obama campaign did a masterful job of painting Mitt Romney as out of the mainstream, as this far-right, quote-unquote, severe conservative, to use Romney's own phrase. And that really allowed the Obama team to paint themselves as centrist, even though President Obama is a fairly conventional center-left Democrat. He's not a socialist, not a radical, nothing of the sort, but he's a pretty mainstream Democrat who favors activist government, and he's probably a bit to the left of a lot of voters, but he was able to paint himself and his team was as the moderate centrist alternative, and it worked out quite well for them.
But I wonder, Julian, whether Mitt Romney and his campaign gave the president and his campaign, you know, ammunition to use against them.
Well, he did. Part of it was just a lack of response, which is one of the mysteries people will puzzle over, why the Romney campaign allowed Obama to define him from very early on as someone too far right, as someone too tied to the needs of Wall Street and the business community and not enough to Main Street, as someone who was closer to the Tea Party than you'd think on a lot of these issues. And he didn't offer an effective response until October, when he tried to reposition himself, and he was pretty effective, Romney, when he did that. So I do think in that case he gave them ammunition. But second, there are the policies of the Republican Party, which many think have moved too far to the right. Whether you're talking about tax cuts or deregulation, there are people like Thomas Mann and Norm Ornstein who say the GOP is a party that has moved farther to the right than Democrats have to the left, and they're giving this ammunition in campaigns and making it harder for presidential candidates to reposition themselves in the center. If you agree with that criticism, there is a party problem that the GOP faces.
But, Julian, I wonder, too, with that long GOP primary and all those various debates, and Mitt Romney had to appeal to the base of his own party, whether that ended up hurting him, because he ended up having to change positions as he got into the general election.
Well, for sure. Primaries always cause this problem. There you're appealing to party activists rather than the general electorate, and so you tend to make statements that appeal to the base. He had a long primary. He also had a televised primary, meaning with all those debates, people saw and heard, and it was reported on what was going on. And I think he made just a series of statements and moves that offered fodder to the Obama campaign come September and October, and which also made him look all over the map so that you could raise suspicions when he moved to the center about whether that's really who he was. And so I do think the primary process took a toll on his efforts to win the middle.
Let me get, looks like Theda from Haddonfield to join our conversation. Go ahead, you're on the air. Do we have you, Theda? That would be number four. Okay, she's not there, but we'll get another caller in. David, I'd be curious what you think about how the primary may have hurt Mitt Romney.
Clearly, it was just so elongated that it forced Governor Romney to really just go over and over again the same conservative positions that he probably wasn't all that comfortable taking in the first place. And I think Julian makes an excellent point. It was televised all the way through, which is not something we had even all that long ago, where every little statement on the campaign trail is parsed and dissected and then, of course, used by the opposition in the general election. So I think the primary went on much longer than Mitt Romney ever wanted it to. It also had the effect of kind of making Mitt Romney a default choice. It really showed that the Republican base was not all that excited about him. Mitt Romney was good enough. He was the best of a bad lot compared to Newt Gingrich, Rick Santorum, Rick Perry, Michelle Bachmann, Herman Cain, etc. And there just was never a whole lot of enthusiasm for Romney. And I think the Obama team used that to great effect in the months following.
Julian, we're going to talk more about pollsters in the second hour of the show today, but I wonder whether pollsters won last night as well.
Well, certainly the now famous Nate Silver did,
right.
And you know, he had been predicting this. He had been the one emphasizing how the Electoral College and the polls coming out of it were just favoring Obama, and there wasn't much Romney was going to be able to do, and he was attacked, he was challenged, some conservatives questioned why he has such standing, and turned out he was correct, and there were many other pollsters doing this math. They were just showing the fundamentals of the Electoral College, and certain states that used to be solidly Republican, which no longer were going to result in an Obama victory. So I do think they come out looking generally pretty good. The way they don't is you've had this rise also, as we're talking about, of more partisan polling of both parties, questioning the polling, putting out their own polling. So at the same time, certain legitimate pollsters did well. I think the public is going to end up more skeptical about what they're hearing just because there's so much noise out there in terms of who to follow.
Well, let's take another short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. Just one open line at 1-888-477-9499. We hope to get Theda from Haddonfield on after this very short break, talking with Julian Zelizer. He's a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University, the author of a number of books. Seems like he writes one every year, the new one called Governing America, the Revival of Political History. And also with us is David Marks, editor-in-chief of Politics, P-O-L-I-T-I-X, and he was a senior editor at Politico, and he wrote a book called Going Dirty, The Art of Negative Campaigning. Stay with us. Much more to talk about after this short break. We'll be right back.
Are you or is someone you know overweight? Drexel University is currently enrolling overweight participants in Mind Your Health, a research study evaluating methods of losing weight and keeping it off without medication. These programs are funded by the National Institutes of Health. More information online at drexel.edu/weightloss or 215-762-4900. That's 215-762-4900. Drexel supports WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. A divided electorate, a divided Congress. Can the U.S. become any more polarized than it already is? And what does that mean post-election? Also, a break from politics with jazz singer Melody Gardot. That's Public Radio's daily digest of news and culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
Supporting WHYY, the Krefeld School, a small, progressive, independent college preparatory school for grades 7 through 12. Krefeld offers a learner-friendly curriculum, a visual and performing arts program which includes glassblowing, and an education which is hands-on and experiential. Krefeld strives to foster critically engaged citizens in a community of individuals. Located in Chestnut Hill, Krefeld is widely accessible via public transportation and school buses. Monthly open house dates and admission details at krefeld.org.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen talking with David Mark and Julian Zelizer. And I need to correct myself. We had a caller that said that I was wrong, and apparently indeed I was, that Mitch McConnell made his remarks in an interview that appeared in the National Journal on October 23rd, 2010, and apparently not 2 years before when Obama was just elected. So I stand corrected there. Thank you for doing that. Let me get, looks like Theta from Haddonfield to join our conversation. And Theta, go ahead. You're on Radio Times. I don't know why we can't get Theta on. I'm very sorry to hear that. Let's try another caller. And let me ask you, David Mark, if I could, about the Affordable Care Act. And I know that Mitt Romney, if he had won, said on day one he was going to overturn the Affordable Care Act. And I'm just curious whether you think this will go forward and the future of the president's signature achievement in the first couple of years when he was first couple of years of his first term in office. Go ahead.
That was
been a late night.
That was always one of the more unsupportable claims by Governor Romney on the campaign trail. The notion that he could come into office on January 20th, 2013, and just overturn the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare, as it's sometimes called. Of course, that would have taken an act of Congress, even with the House of Representatives still in Republican hands. It never would have gone through the Senate, let alone, of course, be signed by the president or overridden, overriding a veto by him. So that was always kind of a myth. And I think voters just kind of shrugged at it. I think the attitudes about the Affordable Care Act are baked in at this point. Some people like it, some people don't. I think it'll be a really interesting test in the next few years when a lot of the provisions of the law kick in. 2014 is when the real meat of the law actually becomes active, and we're going to see the Department of Health and Human Services actually writing the regulations that implement this law, and it may actually turn around in public perception as time goes on, because the parts that people like more just have not been enacted yet.
Julian, do you want to weigh in on that? Then we'll get John from Mayfair to join us.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of Obama's second term will revolve around what you might call the politics of implementation. Rather than creating new programs, it will be about making sure what he passed goes into effect, making sure it's popular, making sure it's working smoothly. There are many parts of this law which have not been done yet, which they're not in effect yet, which can be very popular and can continue to grow support for the program as it unfolds. And there are other parts like the health exchanges, which the states play a big role in administering, which are going to be extraordinarily messy and contentious. And so the administration will have to devote a lot of its energy to making sure that this signature accomplishment works well. You know, Medicare took 1 year. It was up and running. This is a lot longer, and I think it's going to consume at least a year or two of his second term.
Let me get, looks like John from Mayfair to join our conversation. And John, go ahead. You're on the air.
Okay, yes. I'd like to ask our guest, and I'll take my answer offline. If the average American does not have large sums of money to run for office or any office, whether it be Congress or Senate, how do we have equal? I mean, how are we equal, the average American, if we don't have, if we can't run against these people with these large sums of money? And I'll take my answer off the air.
John, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. David Mark, let me toss that to you.
There are some people that suggest that campaign finance restrictions, limiting how much money you can give, actually emboldens incumbents, because they already have the power. They already have, there's already an incentive for lawmakers to get that money from people of interest to give to them, and they already have a voice, a bully pulpit, if you will, and that sometimes some people say you should lift campaign finance restrictions so that outside challengers have a chance. That's a, I'll let that to others to decide.
decide whether that's a good idea or not. But this is a long-running problem in American politics. I think it's just simply virtually impossible to try and decouple money from American politics. It goes together. There may be some kind of limitations you could put in about whether money should come from in-state or something of that nature. But as Julian alluded to earlier, I don't see much push on behalf of President Obama in his second term wanting to do this. I don't think it's going to be a high priority. And most lawmakers on Capitol Hill and elsewhere have every incentive to keep the system just how it is, because that's how they got into office in the first place.
Let me see what Janet from Philadelphia has to say. And Janet, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
So this may sound a little naive, and I want to hear what your people say about this, but I feel, and certainly it's affected by the fact that my candidate won. I'm so happy that President Obama won, but I feel my faith is somewhat restored, because with all the money and the attempts at voter suppression on the part of the Republican Party, they didn't win. And so,
I hear
what
you.
What do you think?
Oh, let's find out. Janet, thanks for calling into Radio Times. Julian, how do you see that?
Well, the voter suppression or the voter ID and fraud measures, I think, had a very different consequence in that they intensified voting in the African-American community, in the Latino community, in terms of it seemed like a challenge to the right to vote. And it might have ended up energizing the communities that went for Obama. It wasn't just that it was ineffective. It actually had the opposite effect of bringing people to the polls who were going to support the Democrats. And I think those kinds of measures, which many think were never necessary, that vote fraud is not a big issue, is another area where Republicans have to scratch their heads and wonder whether that's really what they want to invest their time in. And they see some of the negative effects for them as a party.
Well, and David, we saw long lines. We heard stories of people waiting in line for hours, sometimes as long as 7 to 8 hours to vote. And even looking back at what some of the experts and pundits said about the voters not being engaged, I think they were really proved wrong.
Right. This is an issue that President Obama alluded to in Chicago last night in his victory speech, suggesting that there is a real problem with these long voting lines. And this is something I would not be surprised to see the president kind of throw his prestige behind and try and push forward. It's difficult for the president, for any president, because elections, of course, are controlled state by state, and the federal government has a limited role in this, even though there is some Justice Department oversight. I think what was most notable about this was how the Obama campaign tried to adapt to the rules of the game as they were, and not as they wished they were. In Pennsylvania, for instance, there was this rather stringent voter ID law. Most of it later got overturned, but even before that happened, the Obama campaign essentially said, let's not complain, let's just get people registered. If they don't have driver's license, let's get them the state-issued ID that's now required under law. And rather than just complain about it, they tried to take action. I think that's a lesson for campaigns. Even if you don't like the rules, if they are unfair, they probably were in many these cases, you just kind of have to work around them the best you can. And it seemed to be quite effective for the Obama team.
And we're going to talk more about some of these voter ID laws in the second hour. Let me, Janet, thanks for the call. Let's see what Rich from Point Breeze has to say. Rich, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
I just wanted to react to one of the comments made by one of the guests in that there is a lack of moderates on both sides. I just scratch my head when I hear folks say that, because I'm certainly not the first one to observe it, but there's been such a shift in the terrain of political terrain that so far to the right that what is now considered to be moderate was traditionally considered to be a more conservative base. And I think, the days of Nixon or Goldwater, those folks would be outcast in their own party today based on what the litmus test is for most candidates. And I think, now what is considered to be conservative is, you've got the Murdochs and the Paul Ryans I feel like there's been plenty of effort to be, accept moderation on the Democratic Party side. I mean, I'm an active Democratic Party member. I was a poll watcher last night and at the same time, I just feel like, there were, sacrifices made with the health care plan. The single payer was compromised, which I found, to be objectionable, but recognizing that that is part of the process to except you have to concede on some issues. And I just feel like it's, I think there's plenty of moderates, quite frankly, on the Democratic Party side, and I think Barack Obama is an example of one.
Well, that's interesting, Rich. I appreciate the call to Radio Times. And Julian, do you think he has a point there?
Well, that's what's called the, you know, people call the false equivalency issue, meaning it's not that both parties move to the extreme, it's the Republicans are moving much further to the right than Democrats did, and the Democrats have much more room for moderation. There are clearly examples of this. You know, President Obama, Bill Clinton are all people who have consistently compromised with the left. I do think there are moderates in the Republican Party, and I even think that Mitt Romney, that's where his natural inclinations are, and I think on many issues, George W. Bush, if you looked at him on immigration, on education, is not a far-right Republican. But there is a tension, and there's a strong push, especially in the House Republican contingent, to move to the right, and in some ways they're more successful than the liberal base of the Democratic Party has been in getting politicians to listen to them.
Well, and picking up on our caller, David, some have said, you know, would Richard Nixon or even Ronald Reagan, would they have survived a Republican primary in 2011, 2012?
That's a great question, a great counterfactual issue to raise. Probably not in many ways, because they were quite willing to compromise. And we've seen the Democrats in many ways kind of put aside some key issues they probably care about deeply. Gun control hasn't really been raised in a serious way for a dozen years, even in the face of all these terrible shootings. The so-called car check, which would make it easier for people to join union, workers to join unions and have their payroll deducted, that was shelved by the Obama administration, even though they have a labor secretary, Hilda Solis, who is an active supporter on it. Climate change is something that has quite upset his liberal base. So for whatever reasons, Democrats in Congress on the Hill, I think, have been more pragmatic, even if ideologically they're pretty much true believers. There's a reason Nancy Pelosi in the House can keep her leadership position if she wants to. We don't know what her plans are. Usually, after a couple of losing elections, the party leader might get tossed out. But in this case, her caucus or her members are so ideologically liberal that she'll probably stay on. And it's just she's been more pragmatic, frankly, than the other side.
Well, Julian, I know you have to leave us. Any final words before we say goodbye?
No, I do think I would just end by echoing what David has said. And I think the Republicans need to really think after these election results about how they can broaden this electoral college map, and part of it will be wrestling with the Tea Party. And it cost them the Senate, you could argue, with races like Indiana and Missouri. It might very well have cost them the presidential race with Romney unable to escape the shadow of his own party. And I think, you know, Republicans are still alive and well. They control the House. They did okay in the election. But they're going to have to deal with that, and they're going to have to deal with demographics.
Well, always a pleasure, Julian. Thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Professor of History and Public Affairs at Princeton University, author of a new book called Governing America, The Revival of Political History. David Mark, Editor-in-Chief of Politics, staying with us for the rest of the hour, about 5 minutes to go. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Let me see what Paul from Reading has to say. Paul, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call.
You're very welcome.
I basically wanted to say that I believe that Mitt Romney lost the presidential election because he appeared to be flip-flopping throughout the campaign, and I think that was because he was taking pressure from the party. Had he stayed on message and stayed the moderate that he wanted to be, I believe the race would have been totally different. And this, in my humble opinion, is the second time that the right-wing conservative movement of the Republican Party has cost a presidential candidate. They did it to John McCain 4 years ago. They pushed him too far to the right. People didn't want that. People want somebody who's going to be a moderate, who can compromise. I think Governor Romney would have been that. I also think McCain would have been that. And it's time that the party starts to understand that. I understand from your show, from your news show earlier this morning, four Tea Party candidates were sent packing out of Congress. Let that be a message to the Tea Party. Compromise is what people want, not their hard-headed, well, we're not going to compromise on anything. And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Paul, thank you for your humble opinion. David Mark, do you want to respond to that?
I would just say that Mitt Romney probably never would have captured the Republican nomination in the first place had he gone to the middle. He already had to take enough flack over the course of two presidential campaigns for going toward the right. Mitt Romney basically spent his 2008 primary bid trying to prove his conservative bona fides, and then he built on it this time around. So I don't think he had much choice but to go that direction to get the nomination in the first place. I just think it was so much part of Romney's persona at this point that he was a flip-flopper, but from his races in Massachusetts for unsuccessfully for the Senate and then successfully for the governorship a decade ago, he really was a moderate, and then he went far to the right, and I just think that narrative was built in, and it was going to be very difficult for Romney to overcome.
And, David, we're almost out of time here, but the Democrats still control the Senate. The Republicans still control the House, although with different members. Do you anticipate different strategies coming out of those two bodies?
It's going to be, as you say, pretty much the same numbers. It will be interesting to see if Mitch McConnell, the Republican leader, kind of relents a bit and frees his members up to do some compromise. I think in the House, unfortunately, there's a bad omen. Some of the more bombastic members look like they're coming back. Michelle Bachmann on the Republican side. Alan Grayson is returning for the Democrats. And these are cable TV favorites, but they don't really add much to the governing process. So I'm not so optimistic on that front.
Well, on that note, and again, thank you for getting up early, and I appreciate you joining us today on Radio Times.
My pleasure. Thank you.
You're welcome. That's David Mark, editor-in-chief of Politics. He was a senior editor at Politico for about 6 years. He wrote a book called Going Dirty, The Art of Negative Campaigning. We appreciate those phone calls to Radio Times. You can go to our Facebook page or follow us on Twitter. I actually tweeted last night for the first time. And you can check us out online at whyy.org/Radio Times. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thank you for those phone calls. And do stay with us. We've got another action-packed hour of politics coming up next. We'll be right back.